Blog Talk Radio.
Let your hands for Angela.
Butler. Today's interview is with Dr. Mena Demafay. She's the Vice President of Policy Analyst and Research of the Congressional Black Caucus Foundation Incorporated in Washington, D.C. How are you this morning, Mena?
I'm fine. How are you, Angela? Thanks for having me.
I'm doing great, doing great. So this so what we'll be talking about this morning is the school to prison pipeline for black girls, which is a concern of everyone, not just for black males, but for everyone that's incarcerated, not just black men. The black girls, not just the black teenagers, the black girls are increasingly and always have been part of the school to prison pipeline. Am I correct, Mena?
Yes, that's correct. So what I'd like to do first, and thank you again for having me, is kind of give a really brief history of the CBCF so that your viewers understand kind of what we work on, and then what we've been doing in the juvenile justice reform space and how that intersects with the school-to-prison pipeline for girls and boys, for black youth.
Yes,
does that work for you? Okay.
Yes,
so,
ma'am, that is fine.
All right, great. So the reason I like doing this is because a lot of times, many people are aware of our distinguished members of the Congressional Black Caucus that was created in 1971 by 13 members. And in 1976, the Congressional Black Caucus Foundation was created, and that's where I work. It is a 501c3 nonprofit, which basically means that we do not, we're not partisan. We don't advocate for legislation or endorse legislation, but we do research and analysis on policy issues. So in many ways, we serve as a resource and information hub for not just the members of the Congressional Black Caucus, but really for all members of the United States Congress that are interested in programs, policies, and practice that reduces racism and racial disparities in American society. I also want to share with your viewers that we have a really robust leadership institute where we pride ourselves on giving paid internships and free housing to African American college students and postgraduate students across the country. It's one of those things I always say I wish I knew when I was in college because I would have applied, but I was not aware. I knew who our black elected officials were. I did not know that the Congressional Black Caucus Foundation puts more black interns on Capitol Hill than any other organization in the country. And the reason I think that's important is because when we talk about issues like the juvenile justice issues around black youth and adults being incarcerated in a system that, you know, that it discriminates based on race, we need to ensure that we are doing everything we can to empower the next generation of black leaders to carry this cause on. not only on the Hill, but in their communities, in conversations like we're having right now. There are a lot of ways to give voice to this issue. And so I just want to let everyone know that we give scholarships out to students, undergraduate and graduate. You can go to our website, or you can just Google CBCF or Google Congressional Black Caucus Foundation, or go to www.cbcfinc.org. We have all of our information there to apply for scholarships, to come to the Hill and work for a member of Congress, and get professional development and go on to serve your community. So we and the research department at the Congressional Black Caucus Foundation, we work in four core areas: public health, education, economic development, and environmental sustainability. And what, you know, we're seeing as a country is that a lot of these issues don't operate and should not operate in silos. That, in fact, when we talk about the criminal justice system, it's very much related to educational opportunity, to the kind of job that you or your parents or your family have, to the environment you live in, whether you're in rural or urban communities, what kind of resources do you have to take care of your family and children, and as well as staying healthy, because without your health, you know, you can't do much. And so these are all interrelated. And so for the foundation, we're very keen on making sure that when we talk about the school-to-prison pipeline, we're really taking into account the total environment in which a black young kid, boy or girl, grows up. It's too easy to just say, you know, these stereotypical things that we have to deal with, that, oh, they're just lazy, or, you know, they're not working hard enough. That's completely false. All the data we have tells us very clearly that racism is alive and well today, and policymakers have the very difficult job to try to find solutions. And I respect all our members of Congress. They are trying to get it right, but they have different ideas about what works and what doesn't. And so we try to fill the gap by saying, you know, when you look at how our public education system works, let's say you look at the data, why is it that we have so many black people in our community in prison? You really have to look at the whole life trajectory of experiences that they have had in a system that has at its foundation a core of a racial discrimination that dates back to slavery, that still accounts for almost all the racial disparities that we have today, including the school-to-prison pipeline.
Yes, ma'am. So I understand everything that you're saying, but Brown versus Board of Topeka, I know you know about that.
Yes.
Of course, you're. So that's not really being fulfilled, because if you look at when you talk about the school to prison pipeline, not just for black girls, but for black males as well, and the number of black people who are in the prison system, in prison, that's not counting. It's like 60 to 65%, and then it's like with 12 to 13% of the United States of American population. Also, that's not counting probation, jail. Because right now there's what they call juvenile delinquency system, because about 20 to 25 minutes where I live is Mariana, Florida, and there's the Dozier Boys School there.
Mm-hmm.
And during segregation, there were numerous young black children. I'm just going to say children, males, because it's strictly for boys. And they were segregated in mass graves over there. But they closed it, the governor of Florida did. But it still happened. And the NAACP has been on my show, the four different NAACP members, and it's horrible. I'm praying that it doesn't get to that point again where there are mass graves and little.
So, yeah, you mentioned Brown. Go ahead.
Yes, ma'am. Brown versus Board of Education That's what I'm talking about. That, and I also like to know, what do you do? How do you combat this with the Black Caucus? Because I know the Black Caucus is, you know, legendary,
yeah.
And they do a whole lot, a lot of things people don't know about. But you're part of that. You're with the Black Caucus. So what do you all do? And I also like for you to touch on what happened in South Carolina to the teenage Black girl that the resource officers threw around in her desk.
Yeah.
And threw her around too. How does that affect Black? How do you feel that affects the Black girls? And how does that affect the young Black teenage men who are watching? Do you think that may teach them or make them believe that that's how young Black women should be treated?
Yep. So you hit on a lot of important topics, and I think starting historically, just understanding the nature of educational opportunity and the lack thereof in the Black community is really important. Our history is so important to preserve. It's becoming more difficult with the next generation. You know, the civil rights leaders, fought for this, but even before then, I mean, Brown versus Board of Education reversed Plessy versus Ferguson, which made it unconstitutional and illegal to segregate based on race. And so in the school system, we saw, you know, four Black girls and many other Black folks in our community take that step for an education that was denied to them. And even in the voting booth, there were literacy clauses. You know, this desire among Black folks dating back to slavery to educate themselves and be denied, and then to want to vote and be denied, and to be challenged through all kinds of voter suppression type of tactics that we are still facing in many ways today. So
yes,
integration into the school system, it was a great thing. I mean, and at the same time we were integrating into the education system, we were also integrating into our United States Congress. And so we've gone from 13 in 1971 to currently 49 members of the Congressional Black Caucus. That is the most in history of the United States Congress that we've ever had. We have three Black senators, Senator Booker and Senator now Kamala Harris from California. Both of them are members of the Congressional Black Caucus. Senator Tim Scott from South Carolina is Black, but he is not a member of the Congressional Black Caucus, nor has he ever been. We also have one other African-American Republican from Texas named Will Hurd, who's in his second term, I believe, and he's not a member of the CBC either, so I just want to be clear about that. But in the count in terms of how many Black members we have, whether Republican or Democrat, we are, even more than 49. We're upwards of 52. So we do have one Republican member, by the way, Congresswoman Mia Love from Utah. So a lot of these members of the CBC have been very, very committed to criminal justice reform, to juvenile justice reform. A lot of these issues around the treatment of Black youth in school and the school-to-prison pipeline in many ways was highlighted under the Obama administration, particularly by the Department of Education, when they released a bunch of reports that that really took a hard look at this school-to-prison pipeline issue and how school disciplinary action was leading Black folks down a path that they did not deserve. And
right.
A lot
yes,
of
ma'am.
Research...
They were not treated equally. They're not treated equally at all.
No, they're not.
At all. But
no,
so the white peers or the white students do not get the punishments that they get, expulsion, suspension. They don't always get that, the white students. But they're friends with each other. You know what I'm saying?
You're absolutely right.
They're friends with each other, and there's nothing wrong with that. But then, once they grow up, the differences are seen. You get what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah.
When Black and white grow up and they get out of school, more discrimination, because usually the white kid, the white friend, the home guy, the homeboy, the homegirl can usually get a job. and go to college and things, but rely on their parents or something. You know what I'm saying? And then
yep.
the black student is left out there because of what's happened in high school or middle school.
You're absolutely
right.
If I
already got a record that's supposed to not even carry over into adulthood.
That's exactly right. And
it's not even supposed to carry over.
You're absolutely right. I mean, we know, the U.S. has, unfortunately, we have a long way to go in this space. We are 5% of the world's population. We're 25% of the prison population. You know, 40% of students expelled from U.S. schools every year are black. That's almost half. That's terrible. 70% of students involved in school arrests or referred to law enforcement are black or Latino. I mean, the statistics go on and on. Black students are 3.5 times more likely to be suspended than white students. So
You said 5% of the world population?
We are 5%. The United States is 5% of the world's population. We're 25% of the prison population. So what that means is that the United States incarcerates more people than any other country in the world, and that is terrible because it says something about the way we deal with our problems and issues. And so if we know that someone's economic opportunity or lack thereof or not having a job or being discriminated against in the education system, if we know those things are happening and we decide to solve it by just putting folks in prison, given the way racial discrimination already operates, we're not helping ourselves and we're certainly not helping our black community. This is the double burden that black people have faced forever. I mean, we have not come, we've made progress, but progress is relative. And so to say that, President Obama, it shows us that these problems don't matter anymore is the furthest thing from the truth. So if we know that black students, the statistics show that black students are 3.5 times more likely to be suspended than white students, what does that tell you? Well, a lot of opponents will say it tells us that black students are more troublesome and have a worse behavior than whites. That would be a superficial, incorrect way, in my opinion. But there are people out there, right, who this is, again, goes back to the stereotypes of black people. People will look at these statistics and say, well, there's something wrong with black folks. They get in trouble more than white people, and that's why they're 3 times more likely to get suspended. Well, wait a minute. When we know racial discrimination has a lot to do with a teacher in a classroom deciding to drag a girl across out of her desk as opposed to talking with her or getting to the root cause of what's happening. I mean, we're seeing things on video that black folks and others have known for decades. You know, whether you're talking about police brutality and our people getting killed on the street by cops, when you talk about the onset of Black Lives Matter, this is not an epiphany. This is not black people waking up to the fact that waking up to the fact that this doesn't happen to us on a daily basis. We know this happens to us on a daily basis. The rest of the country, some are willfully ignorant, and others choose to say, otherwise. And so now what we're seeing are students in classrooms, catching teachers calling them the N-word, dragging, beating them. And so we know there's a major problem. And in our research department, what we try to do is provide the data that shows that this is the case. And that's where I think in a post-civil rights society, as black scholars, researchers, activists, and you don't have to be black to support the cause either. I mean, we're talking about equality and equity, which everyone should believe in as a fundamental American value. We need to use data to show that racial disparity still exists, and that in many ways has a lot to do with why we are still wrestling with these dismal statistics. You mentioned what we were doing in terms of our work with the Congressional Black Caucus. There are several. It's, you know, not just putting legislation out there to reverse this. We have people like Congressman Robert C. Scott, known as Bobby Scott from Virginia, who has for so long been pushing legislation around promoting education and rehabilitation at a very young age. Kids across the board are for the most part innocent. They grow up in neighborhoods they didn't choose, with a society they often didn't pick. And they are thrust into a world where they have to deal with discrimination or be in an area where they may be subject to poor school systems and not the best kind of safe environment to grow up in. So when...
But see, Mena, tell me, I can tell you that. This is the problem I have with Brown versus the Board of Topeka, which is... the education system was sued. That seems to be reversed. Like it's back to the way it used to be in certain, in a lot of things within the school system. It's like it's been reversed back to, because to me, if young people don't have proper books and chairs and computers and laptops and whatever they need to compete in the United States of America and in worldwide, to learn, to grow, to educate themselves and disperse the communities they live in. Everybody that lives in a community where there's, that are labeled bad communities, not necessarily bad communities. Some of those young people and some of the parents, I'm not trying to be derogatory or insulting, but some of those kids never see, let's say, they're in a bigger urban city. Some of them never see the wealthier side of town until, like, in their 20s.
Right.
You get what I'm saying? That there's not enough people going in there and taking them out of the environment and the community. And the reason it's like that, to me, is because of the laws. But I know the laws, but you're...
So, you and I are both...
Nonpartisan.
Yes,
okay. Nonpartisan on that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think I know what you're saying, and so I'm speaking to more of a macro level. You're speaking to the micro level. So obviously, you're correct. There's a lot that parents and communities can do to expose their kids to more opportunity. That's definitely true, and we need to push that. At the same time, at a macro level, you have to look at how systems are shaping societies. To getting to a better position.
But those communities are that way for a reason, in my opinion, because there's not enough resources being put into those communities, such as bus transportation, trains.
That's exactly right.
I was reading some years back, there was not even hardly any busing. I think they call it trains to go to work. For the parents,
yep.
I mean, they were rerouting. I think it was the state of New York, but I'm not certain about it. Maybe California.
Yes. No, I still think we're saying the same thing because, transportation was also used as a way to segregate communities. This is why we see, just like the rich have a generational transfer of wealth to their next of kin, Black communities have been suffering for generations, and unfortunately transferring a lack of those things to their community. It is very hard when you look at the realities of the Black people face, even at a micro level. Take a mother of one kid or two kids who, doesn't have access to the transportation she needs, or he needs for that matter, to get to the next city to get that job, because there's no transportation available. Why is there no transportation available? A lot of times the city taxpayer dollars and the representatives that you have at a local level should be aware of these things and promoting the opportunity for to have sort of economic opportunity available to you outside of your situation, if that's the case. The same goes for the school system. If you can't, if you're in a public school system, and your school doesn't offer the best, you know, quality courses compared to a private school in the city next door, what are you supposed to do? So to me, at a macro level, this is happening all the time in multiple ways throughout history. It's been happening. We can't just look at some urban communities where blacks are the majority and say.
No, it happens in small towns like that. I'm like 30 minutes from Dothan, Alabama. There's been a gentleman there in jail for 10 years, and I think it's 1 year for jail here in the United States of America. So I understand what you're talking about. Go ahead, ma'am.
No, yeah, you're right.
In the rural areas.
Yeah, in the rural areas, too. You're absolutely right. Yes, you're absolutely right. Yeah, you're exactly right. Yes, in the South, we can use that example as well. It's rural and, it's rural and urban, but the common denominator is being black. It's race. Now, and it's not to say that there aren't things we can do as individuals in our community, but again, when you look historically, we are still have to work twice as hard. Black people still have twice the unemployment rate as whites. Whites still have 13 times the wealth of blacks. You can look at every socioeconomic indicator, and that tells you something about these trends that have existed based on race since the abolishment of slavery. And so we're still wrestling with that. When you look at our criminal justice system, there's so many things wrong with the way the justice system works. I don't even know where to start, to be honest. We have some again, we have folks like Congressman Scott.
I'm sorry to be rude. It starts with the laws. And I know you're nonpartisan. You don't get into politics, but it really does start with the law.
Oh, yeah, you're absolutely right. And we do look at the law. We look at legislation that's passed, which is the law. It's public policy. And we look at, and a lot of these things are solved at a state and local level. Who your governor is matters for whether you're going to get on death row or serve 15 to 20 years for a first-time offense. There are folks out there that are part of Ban the Box movement where, job applications are still asking folks to record if they've been convicted of a crime. After you serve, you're being doubly punished. That doesn't help our community. I mean, you have also states that have felon disenfranchisement. And if the goal is to promote civic participation, we all believe voting means expressing your voice. Why really? Why is it that ex-felons can't participate and make their life better by doing the one thing we all say will get them to a better place, which is express, their ability to voice their concerns civically? I mean, that to me is a healthy way to reengage someone coming out of a criminal justice system. But some states say, no, you cannot do that. We don't want ex-felons to have the right to vote.
Well, that's supposed to be all across. I thought that was all across the United States that people had the right to have the vote, voting rights reinstated. But here in Florida, the governor here at one time, here in Florida, was not reinstating people's voting rights. We had felons who'd been in prison.
Yes, you're right. I mean, they're very widely. I think it's Kentucky, Florida, and Iowa that have lifetime disenfranchisement. Basically, in those states of Florida, Kentucky, and Iowa, you cannot. If you have been charged and convicted of a felony, you never have the right to vote. Right. So, we have to ask ourselves, and I would tell people, the Brennan Center for Justice does really great work in the voting space, but we really have to question how our current system is really providing, what can be improved upon, and how is it really providing the opportunity to correct our wrongs and to reduce these racial disparities that are happening. And there's a lot to be done, not just at the federal level. I mean, they have to work too, but you've got state and local representatives, your mayor, you have superintendents of school systems that could change the way teachers are trained to be sensitive to diversity in the classroom, to ensure that they're trained properly to not discriminate based on race. You know, and we're not there yet. We're trying to get there, but it's going to take time. And a lot of the same patterns you see in terms of the treatment of black kids in the classroom, you know, it's the same kind of discrimination. It's analogous to what you see in the criminal justice system in terms of the treatment of black people. And so we have to be really serious about that. Even if you take race out of the equation, we have to question our education policy. When you think about students who might be misbehaving in the classroom, what is the first thing we do? We tend to, you know, teachers tend to want to get rid of the problem by sending them to detention and perhaps suspension if it's a recurring issue. But, you know, teachers also have the responsibility of being looking out for the entire well-being of a student. If that student is then suspended and you have black students being suspended at three times the rate, where are they going if they're not going to school? All you're doing is putting them in a position to not necessarily get better, but to be eliminated from the classroom, the one place where you're there to learn, to get better. And this is where there is a difference of philosophy among some members of Congress. Some want to promote rehabilitation, promote more educational opportunity. I mean, these are young kids. We have to treat them like that. And give them the chance to get better. But if you just think about punitive measures and punishing, when you don't know that's the history of where that student's been, or a matter of fact, we don't know where the teachers, what the guidelines are in terms of how they decide and when they decide to kick a black kid out of the classroom, we have to question that. And we need people who can hold teachers and superintendents and school districts accountable. We need people that can hold officers and law enforcement accountable. We have to have a discussion with understanding how the parents' role can shape the kids. I mean, there's a reason why we see high correlations of these problems in certain areas and not in others. And again, I mean, the onset of technology has allowed us in many ways to bring this to light and to show people that, yeah, teachers discriminate in the classroom and they physically assault children in the classroom. And you're seeing this all over. And so those deniers that say this is not a problem now have to wrestle with this. So we need people at every level to be operating.
Yes, and I'm doing my best here with this show. I strictly do the internet, but I'm doing my best and through social media. I know you're nonpartisan.
Yes.
Thank you, ma'am. I know you're nonpartisan. I'm trying to reach more people too. You are nonpartisan. I want to say this. I want to make sure I don't mess this up. I want everyone to know that the Congressional Black College Site is nonpartisan. Okay, the foundation is. But I also would like to say if they are nonpartisan. But I just like people in Florida to know that, now remember, they're nonpartisan. Okay, this is me, Angela Shotow. Angela, just want to say the Florida Vote Direct Registration for Fellas Initiative is coming up on the voting ballot 2018. Please don't stop coming on my show, ma'am, because I said that. Because this has nothing to do with you. This is the state that I live in, Florida. Because as we all know, Florida has the most punitive disenfranchisement policies in the country, permanently barring all citizens with felony convictions from voting unless they individually apply to the state office of executive clements for restoration. Right. Okay, go ahead, ma'am.
It might help. Yeah, no problem. It might help to also share with your viewers that the Congressional Black Caucus is a bipartisan caucus. They are made up of all elected officials on the Democratic and Republican side. As I mentioned with the CBCF, we're nonpartisan. We're 501c3. There's also the CBC PAC that raises money to put black elected officials in office. And then there's the Congressional Black Caucus Institute, which is a 501c4, which means that they actually do advocate for legislation. So there are four different entities out there that have their ties to representing the interests of Black communities and individuals across the country. We do work in cooperation with the Congressional Black Caucus and other members on both sides of the aisle, and we focus more on laws that have already been passed and analyze to what extent they have continued to maintain racial gaps and how we can sort of ensure that they get eradicate those racial gaps. So that's
yes.
kind of where
you do
step up.
The what you're saying is, Mana, that's what you told me, Kali, is that what your organization does, you are very much with the Black Congressional Black Caucus, which is the foundation, and that you put your what you do. The Congressional Black Caucus and Foundation is policy analysts and research there in Washington, D.C. Am I correct?
You're correct. That's correct.
Okay.
So to give you an example and your viewers what we do, for instance, we had a transportation research fellow, which we're going to renew, working for us on transportation equity issues. And under the prior administration, we were doing work to promote the Department of Transportation to ensure that they look at job opportunities that may be changing for African Americans in light of the technological advancements that are being made in transportation. So we were a voice at the table. We provided research. All of our publications are on our website and can be downloaded, and we use those resources to share with members of Congress. We have done in the juvenile justice space, we have worked with Congresswoman Barbara Lee of California and Congressman Bobby Scott from Virginia very closely, as well as others like our chairwoman, Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee from Houston, who's on the Judiciary Committee, and she's on Homeland Security, and she's been a really strong, all of them strong voices for juvenile justice reform. We received funding from the Annie E. Casey Foundation to put on a series of policy forums on the Hill where we were bringing experts across the country to look at things like recidivism in the criminal justice system, the school-to-prison pipeline that leads our Black students down a path that they don't deserve and can easily be corrected. Targeted legislative staff working for the Judiciary Committee and the Education and Workforce Committee, because they essentially write legislation and promote policies that would help us get to a better place. So we serve in the capacity of our information resource and try to provide answers to reducing these gaps and advancing the global Black community in all of these areas that we work on. So that sort of sums up, what we do. I will also let your viewers know that every September, every third week of September in Washington, D.C., we have our annual legislative conference. We just celebrated our 47th annual legislative conference. It takes place at the Washington Convention Center. Upwards of 10,000 people attend. It's free and open to the public. We encourage people to come. They come from all over the country. All of the CBC members are there, and they co-host policy sessions. There's over 100, policy sessions and events aimed at bringing our community together. Civil rights activists are there, celebrities with a cause for the promoting opportunity in the Black community are there, and we encourage your viewers to join us during that time, because we learn from each other. There are organizations across the country, local-based, community-based organizations, nonprofits, you name it, they are there promoting affordable housing, promoting a successful reentry of incarcerated individuals, promoting voting rights for felons and other communities. So we have a lot of work to do, and we need our partners on the ground. So that also is a big opportunity to engage with us from all over the country. So please join us for that. The 48th annual legislative conference will be coming up in 2018 of September, and we'll keep you posted on the details, but you can always visit our website for more information.
Okay. I know you recently had a 47th annual legislative conference and Still I Rise on September 20th to the 24th of this year. It says your keynote speech was Mr. Charles, it says it was Bishop Charles E. Blake Sr., and the music headline was Pastor Shirley Caesar.
Yes.
I hope that was a success. Okay. All right.
Yes. So we had that was for the prayer breakfast.
Go ahead, ma'am.
Yeah, that was for the prayer breakfast, which takes place on Saturday morning. And then we have a Phoenix Awards dinner where we award distinguished kind of role models and leaders in the Black community. And so those two events are ticketed events, so everyone's invited, but it is a fundraising conference, and the money and donations we get from that conference allow us to continue to offer paid internships and free housing for Black students across the country. So, you know, a lot of people come to support the cause. All of the policy issue forums are mostly free. But yes, we do have a prayer breakfast. We want to hear from our faith-based leaders in terms of what they're doing on the ground and galvanizing the community and addressing some of these serious issues. So that's a well-attended event, same with our Phoenix Awards dinner. We've got about sort of 4,000 folks who come to attend that dinner, and it's a really grand affair. It's very inspiring, very empowering to be there, and, you know, we've got a really committed board of directors. Everyone from Kathy Hughes to Judge Greg Mathis are on our board, and they are pushing these issues around economic opportunity, juvenile justice reform. We had a really packed event last September with Judge Mathis moderating on the juvenile justice system. And, you know, sharing information really makes us stronger and makes us better. We can learn from each other, and instead of reinventing the wheel, we're much better off partnering with folks who are already doing the good work and amplifying that work.
So you had said that there were students that you were helping to work in Washington, D.C., and also with the Department of Transportation. I think it's great what you're doing with the things
Thank
that
you.
Are going on with the educational system. It seems like they've been trying to reverse it as much as they can. I guess that's why so many those who can't and from these parts send their children, their sons and daughters, other places to go to school from these parts, those that can. What do you believe? I think it's great, but I just have one question. Do you know in your what you believe should be did about the education system, all the discrimination? I know you're doing everything you can, and I respect that, admire that, but in your opinion, what more can be done? And also, you've got about 2 minutes. Could you talk about the young people and how they can get in touch with you and sign up for those points
sure.
that you were talking about and opportunities? 2 minutes.
Yes, sure. So what can be done is the question, right? And part of what we want to do is raise awareness in our community and really, you know, step up and speak out. There are many ways to do this. I mean, and I think we need to demystify the idea that people have to come all the way to Washington, D.C. to make some change. What you do at a local level has everything to do with shaping immediately the future of your children and communities. And so both can happen at the same time. I often think young people sometimes get the bad end of the stick. We think that they're young and naive, but as we see the Black Lives Matter movement take off in unprecedented ways, we need to be part of that social movement. The youth are some of our smartest and strongest leaders. They're educating themselves every day in the classroom while many of us are at work trying to pay the bills and take care of our families. When you think about it, young people...
The show's getting ready to end.
Okay, and so I would just say, yeah, I would just say that, you know, be aware, join an organization, speak out, go to local hearings, testify, ask your city council member to represent your interests, tell them your concerns, fight for those around you and not just for your sort of the people you know, and join us in our mission at the Congressional Black Caucus Foundation. Come to our website, CBCF.